So what are you thankful for this holiday season? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on the Larry Miller Show. And of course, gotta say thankful for Larry every day. But of all the things that we would be thankful for, I did not have this at the top of my list, and maybe I should. We're joined this morning by PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, an entomologist, and we're talking about bugs this morning. And if you have any bug questions, we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you have pictures to send, you can send them on, and we'll take a look at them in the studio. Email talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And PJ Leash, welcome back to the Larry Miller Show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Of all the things to be thankful for this holiday season, friends and family, of course, top of the list. WPR listeners, they're just friends I haven't met yet, or family that's supporting me today. Thanks for listening, Mom and Dad. But bugs, we should be thankful for bugs this holiday season. Leave it to an entomologist to put the insects at the top of our list. Why, PJ?
There's really a whole bunch of different reasons, and insects are the single most abundant and diverse group of animals on the planet. If you think about it, if we made a list of all the vertebrates, those are animals with a backbone, so you and I, dogs, fish, cats, birds, stuff like that, and we come up with a list and we have that number, there are beetle families that have a longer list than that, and there's over 100 families of beetles. So it's mind-boggling how many insects are out there, and they're doing things that, unless you take the time to take a close look, it's very easy to miss what they're doing. And of course, I mean, this is true in life. The squeaky wheel gets the oil. So when there are insect pests that are doing something we don't like, that is going to get our attention. But the overwhelming majority, like 95%+ of all the insects out there, are doing something beneficial for us in the ecosystem. And anytime they do something like that, we refer to that as an ecosystem service. And another way to phrase that is it's something Mother Nature is doing so that we don't have to. They are pollinators. Mm-hmm. And in general, roughly one out of every three bites of food that we eat is due to insects. And you might say, well, what about the other two-thirds? And, you know, especially our Western diet, very heavy in things like corn and wheat, which primarily wind pollinated. But if we were to go to the grocery store, look at the produce section. A lot of that is because of insects. So a couple things that really came to mind with Thanksgiving, cranberries. I love cranberries. Cranberries. We need insects to have that cranberry sauce on the dinner table tomorrow.
I'm so proud of my cranberry sauce this year. Like, I'm bragging about my cranberry sauce, but I'll also have to add that insects are partly responsible for my cranberry sauce.
Yeah. So things like that. Also, other, you know, produce, vegetables, pumpkins,
sure.
Squash. So
sure.
The pumpkin pie tomorrow, if you have baked butternut squash or anything like that.
Thank the bugs.
Exactly. So pollination, that's a key, really important thing. And I feel most folks can recognize that. But they also do a lot of really important things in terms of, like, decomposition and nutrient cycling. They're nature's garbage men, if you think about it that way. But they're just working in the background to break down rotting plant material, roadkill, stuff like
sure.
that.
Yeah.
Get the nutrients back into the ecosystem.
They're the start of our food cycle. They're the end of our food cycle. And they yeah. are points in between to our food cycle that if one out of every three bites of our food relies on an insect to make it possible, if you take the insects away, we're going to have a very clear Thanksgiving table.
Exactly. And then, you know, they are a base of food webs, as you just mentioned, mm-hmm. critical to our food webs. Lots of things feed on insects. That can be fish and aquatic systems. Plenty of terrestrial things, birds feed on them, including turkeys. Turkeys can be omnivores, feed on a range of things, and that can include insects. So when you're eating that turkey tomorrow, you know, if it was a wild one that maybe you hunted out in nature, they were probably feeding on insects somewhere along the lines.
So they play a crucial role in our lives and our food cycle. But what about the pests, PJ, and how they, like you say, are the squeaky wheel and get the grease and get all our attention, that everything else seems to run almost on its own in the background. But what about when they get in our way?
Yeah. And that, again, when it comes to public perception, if we were to walk down the street and poll people, insects, good or bad, you're going to get a mixture of thoughts. In a lot of cases, it may slant to the negative because it's a few of those bad apples in the bunch that get her attention. You know, some insects are kind of hard to show love for. Mosquitoes, I say, would probably fall into that category.
PJ, but, do you love mosquitoes?
You know, there are some neat ones out there. I mean, there are plenty of mosquitoes that have no interest in biting humans whatsoever. Mosquitoes can
be
pollinators.
We love those mosquitoes.
You know, when they're biting, maybe not.
Right.
But they are a base of food webs and aquatic systems.
Yes.
Above ground, dragonflies and birds and things like that are feeding on them too.
When you're on and we get calls in, we regularly hear people concerned about the reduced population of bugs, that we used to see them everywhere and now we don't see them anywhere, that they used to cover up our car windshield in ways that would make us stop to clean it off, and we don't have that experience anymore. The fields of lightning bugs have disappeared from my yard. Those stories like that, do those stories concern you, or are those a part of the big picture of the life cycle of the insects?
Yeah, great question. Those stories do concern me.
Okay.
And when you think about it, I mean, we just talked about all the really critically important things that insects can do for it. And we touched the tip of the iceberg. We could have gone on and on for a full hour on that. They do so many important things for us, but we are seeing a growing body of evidence that insects are facing threats and are declining. It's hard to study this. They're so small. There's not enough experts to look at all of these. But again, there are studies coming out all the time. One recent one came out of Colorado, or I should say it was published by a researcher in North Carolina, if I remember correctly. But the research was in southwestern Colorado, beautiful area. My wife and I love to head out there. And this was a habitat area up in the mountains that relatively untouched by humans. It's not like it had been, you know, bulldozed and made into apartments and malls and stuff like that, relatively untouched. And over the course of time, the number of insects have been dropping over the years. And that is very alarming. You could understand, you know, a habitat that's highly modified by humans.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of say, yeah, that makes sense. But when you're looking at kind of more wilderness type areas and insects are declining, that's very alarming.
Are there hypotheses as to why that is?
There are, in the general consensus at the moment, and this is something that I think we're going to hear more and more about over the coming decade or so, it's that there's not one single cause. It's really death by a thousand paper cuts. There's all these interacting factors. And I like to make the analogy, if it were one single thing, we just flip that one switch in the other direction and fix it. It's a whole bunch of things. It is land use change, human activities that could be agricultural or just building, the way that we design the landscape around us. You know, if we put in a turf grass lawn and that's the only thing we have in our yard, for example. But there's other factors too. This is related to weather and climate. Climate change is being looked at, especially the study I mentioned in southwestern Colorado. Mm-hmm. They think that is one of the things. They'd notice you have a really warm year and the following year, insect populations down. Drought is also being looked at. So with climate change and more extreme weather patterns, that can be really hard on insects. So again, it's a whole bunch of interacting factors, makes it really hard to kind of tug out which are the main ones.
So PJ Leash, if I am as thankful for insects as you are today, what could I do for their population?
Yeah, great question. And a couple of really simple things that come to mind. And these are things that I feel anyone can do in your own yard or in your neighborhood or just the general places where you live. That can be reducing the amount of pesticide that you use. In a lot of cases, or ask yourself, is that pesticide really necessary? You know, maybe you go out and you have some weeds. Could you do some alternative approach, hand picking or something like that? Or if you need to use a pesticide, could we use one that maybe has short persistence, is not going to last as long in the environment? Is it known to be less toxic, for example? I mean, along those lines, there's a very wide range of insect pests that I regularly answer questions for in home gardens and yards, that you can manage those pests with things like insecticidal soap and horticulture oils, which sometimes is just like a mineral oil or a soybean oil and things like that. You have to understand the limitations of those products, but if you use a soap or oil versus maybe a conventional product that's going to last for 2 weeks, you know, we can make some decisions there. And I think also changing human perspectives. You know, to us, we might see a weed in a lawn, maybe it's violets, for example, and some folks just don't want those in their lawn. But to us, we might call it a weed. To insects, that can be a food source. That can be pollen and nectar, for example. Along the lines of violets, there's actually a species of butterfly that specifically lives on violets. And so if you have violets in your lawn, you may be supporting that particular butterfly. If you don't, you're not providing any resources for it. So there's really a number of things we can do. Minimizing pesticide use. One interesting thing, especially during the summer months, there's evidence about light pollution. There's actually a term for it, which is ALIN, artificial lighting at night. And we know that this can disrupt insect behavior. We know that moths in particular often like to come to lights. But think of a very charismatic insect, fireflies.
Right.
They rely on light to mate for their behavior. And if they're being distracted by all these strings of patio lights and things like that, there is building evidence that light pollution and artificial lighting at night can be harmful to insects.
So there, those are really simple, some low-hanging fruit and something each and every one of us can take the time to do if we are as thankful for insects as you are today, PJ Leash. And to me, it's interesting that an entomologist sees the smallest parts of the world that we're not even looking at most days. But that changes the big picture of the world that you see compared to the rest of us. So to see the world through your eyes is not just looking at the smallest things, it's looking at the whole globe and how all of these parts are crucial to making, you know, to putting us here today, to putting the dinner on our plate tomorrow, to bringing us together, friends and family alike. You can thank the insects for that.
Definitely.
PJ Leash, our guest today, entomologist, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, giving thanks today, and thankful for you as well. If you'd like to join the show, if you have questions about the bugs that you've seen around your home, or maybe who have been imported through some fresh Christmas decorations, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're also taking pictures of your insects today with your questions at talk@wpr.org. You can email talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Taking a look at the insects around Wisconsin today, along with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Our guest, PJ Leash, entomologist and manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Let's go to Lee in Green Bay next. Lee, good morning.
Good morning. A couple months ago, I stumbled across what I call the ground hornets or the ground bees. I was doing some brushing on my property, and I didn't know that hole was there. And I'll tell you, that's the worst I've ever been stung up bad.
How many times?
I left the nest alone. And will they come back? Will there be a queen that'll winter there or whatever?
Yeah, great question. PJ, what's happening to the ground bees over the winter?
Yeah, so what it sounds like is you probably bumped into, I suspect, ground nesting yellow jackets, which due to their size and the appearance, their coloration, they have these very conspicuous black and yellow stripes. Folks often mistakenly call them ground bees. Mm-hmm. What I think of as a ground bee tends to be very different. These are solitary creatures. Their nest, it's one individual, looks like a little anthill, very docile, very gentle. The only thing that's going to live in the ground is like a colony would be bumblebees. And most folks recognize bumblebees because they're
big and
usually
fat.
Larger, robust, very hairy in terms of their appearance. Mm-hmm. So when someone is like mowing their lawn and they get stung by a bunch of things, it's almost always going to be ground nesting yellow jackets. We've got a couple of common species like German yellow jacket, Eastern yellow jacket that'll do that. Now, the biology of these is they have annual life cycles. And to be honest, bumblebees have basically the same kind of story. So the colony naturally dies out in the fall due to two reasons. One is starvation. They run out of resources. They are predators. They also can be pollinators and go for nectar and pollen. Well, as the plants start to senesce and insects feeding on those plants, i.e. their prey disappears, they starve to death. If they're still hanging on and we get a cold frost like it is today, that would finish them off too. The only members of the colony that survive, those colonies in kind of latish summer will produce a batch of new queens. They leave, they mate, they mix the gene pool, and then those queens go somewhere sheltered and they hunker down. That could be a rotten log or somewhere else. In spring, it's a roll of the dice and it's a mad dash. Those overwintered queens are trying to establish nests, and the vast majority of them will fail. They get eaten by something, or, you know, something happens and they just do not succeed. It's going to be a small percentage, but when those queens are out in spring, they're going to be looking for potential nesting sites. They're generally not going to go back to an old nest. And a reason for that, well, what if that nest or nesting site had died out because of a disease, for example? Mm-hmm. If you go back to the same spot, you're setting yourself up for disaster. So they're looking for new spots that can include things like pre-existing holes in the ground. They're not great diggers to begin with, but if there's a start of a hole, maybe it's an old chipmunk burrow, gopher hole, something like that. Maybe it's a location where a tree stump is there and it's rotted away and there's a hollow void. They can get in there and build a nest, but at first it's that lone queen. She's got to do all the work, get food, make the nest, raise young, and so on. Over time, she builds a workforce. They go out and do the more dangerous work. She stays there. So the colony builds up from spring, reaches peak size in about August, September. That is why so many folks have this situation where you've been mowing all summer, no issues.
Right.
All of a sudden, the colony's at peak size, maximum number of mouths to feed. They're also hangry because they're starting to run out of food. So they get kind of ornery. In August, in September,
right.
That's when stings happen. But the good news is two things. First, that nest has died out by now.
Okay.
The second thing is, just because you had one this year doesn't mean that they're going to be back next year.
Thank you for the call, Lee. And it does bring me back to mosquitoes. What are mosquitoes doing right now? Where are they?
Depends on the type of mosquito.
How do they overwinter and come back every spring like they do?
Depends on the type of mosquito. So we, in Wisconsin, we've got about 55 different species of mosquitoes. These are spread out a bunch of different genera. So, you know, if you think of it as kind of genealogy, you've got the Smiths and the Larsons and stuff like that. You know, these are different genera, and then there's species within those genera. And each genus can have kind of its own habits. So we have some genera and some mosquitoes that overwinter as eggs. And so those might be in low-lying areas out in the woods.
Okay.
The females laid eggs there in these spots that are prone to holding water. And that could be water from melting snow in spring. That could be rain, flooding events in spring or summer months. And that kind of lights the fuse, and those eggs hatch and develop.
How long can those eggs stay dormant? Generally.
It depends on the mosquito. Some are going to hatch relatively quickly. Some that go through that strategy, like our floodwater mosquitoes, the eggs might sit there for a year, two, three, four, or even more, just waiting for the right conditions when those rains come. We do have other mosquitoes, like the genus Culex. Culex pipiens is a northern house mosquito. That's one that's associated with West Nile virus, like in urban areas,
ooh,
for example.
Yeah.
But also the genus Anopheles, which historically had been involved with transmission of malaria in places like Wisconsin. You go back to the early, mid-1800s, we had malaria here in the state of Wisconsin. Nowadays, not an issue for us, but Culex and Anopheles, they can overwinter as adults in sheltered locations. So last weekend, when it was about 50 or so, I'm cleaning my garage and I find an adult Anopheles. And you might say, mid-November, we shouldn't have any mosquitoes.
That's exactly what I'd say, PJ.
If you understand, well, this is a type that overwinters as adults. They are looking for some sort of sheltered, buffered location. So that can include garages and sheds. Out in nature, that might be a hollow log, a rock pile, a small cave, or rock overhang, or something like that.
They're not biters, though, are they?
Well, this time of the year, they're pretty lethargic.
Yeah.
But in theory, you know, if it got warm enough in November, in December, really any time of the year, they could potentially become active. Now, probably not really aggressively trying to get a blood meal at this time of the year. Physiologically, they have some things that can kind of shut things down.
Okay.
They're not in the mode of laying eggs. But the point I want to make is when things warm up in spring, let's say we have an early start to spring and it's March and it's 65 degrees, there's some mosquitoes that can pop out right away because they were adults and have been there for months.
So it is possible to get a mosquito bite in Wisconsin in the wintertime.
Not likely, but it could happen. It could potentially happen. Again, if you had some of those like in your garage and they came into your house, could be possible.
Now, I have seen a lot of Asian lady beetles in my house this year, and I remember from past conversations that if they're already in your house, it's probably too late. So, but on the upside, no box elders. I haven't seen any brown marmorated stink bugs, and I believe PJ, these are the kind of bugs that you talk about trying to overwinter inside our house, and what we can do to try to prevent it.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of things: the multicolored Asian lady beetles, the box elder bugs, brown marmorated stink bugs. There's also something called a cluster fly. I've had lots of calls about this year. Every year, it kind of varies. It's up and down for each of those species. The box elder bugs, for example, they tend to do really well under drier conditions. If it's really rainy, really damp, they can basically come down sick with some fungal diseases. There's all sorts of pathogens that affect insects and help regulate their populations. So if we have, and you know, you rewind about two-ish years, and we had a couple years there that were pretty dry in Wisconsin, and I saw box elder bug populations build up. It's been rainier the last year or two at the right time of the year, and populations have gone back down. But it's been a really good year for the multicolored Asian lady beetles that like to get into our house. Lots of reports of those from around the state. I have seen plenty myself. So good year for those. Good year for cluster flies as well, which love to get into homes and cabins and things like that.
So what can you do once they're inside your home? Nicely escort them out?
My main recommendation, if you see an occasional one here or there, grab them with a tissue, get the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner and suck them up. It generally doesn't make sense to spray indoors. From the point of view of those insects, they really don't want to be active in your house this time of the year over the winter months. From their point of view, they want to come in, find a sheltered spot, hunker down, spend the winter, leave in spring. They only have so much energy stored up in their body and fat stores and things like that. And so if they come into your living quarters and they're active, they're burning through the gas in their tank, so to speak. They are desiccating because it's pretty dry during the winter months. Pretty harsh conditions for them. So again, not great for them. These insects we talked about, they are not laying eggs or reproducing in our homes.
Okay.
They are just coming in and they're kind of wandering aimlessly.
Staying warm. They're coming in for a little warmth.
Well, they are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If they were outside experiencing the brunt of the cold, that'd be very hard on them. But they get into a sheltered location and out in nature, that could be a hollow log, a rock pile, something like that. In the native range of those lady beetles we're talking about in parts of China, they actually will use visual cues and fly to cliffs.
What?
Where they see like horizontal and vertical cracks. That's where they go. They use these visual cues. And so when you think about our houses with siding, they're mistaking that for their native habitat.
Cliffs and cracks.
Basically, they're using those visual clues. And so that can orient them to houses. I see a strong pattern, especially if you're like a house out in the country on top of a hill, that can really orient them to places like that.
So take it for what it's worth this season, and then once we get to the spring and it warms up a little bit and they evacuate the house, try to find those little spots and close them up so they don't come in next season?
Yeah, that's the best thing in the long run. Figure out how and where they're getting in, seal that up. Caulk, expanding insulation foam, weather stripping, and so on.
PJ Leash, our guest, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or email us, and we'll take your pictures as well, talk@wpr.org. Kathleen emailed us a picture of a Chinese mantis. It was photographed in their community garden just a few weeks ago. iNaturalist reported this Chinese mantis as invasive, saying, "We should destroy this bug." What do you think, PJ? What should they do with this Chinese mantis from just a few weeks ago?
Well, at this point, it's almost certainly dead. Even if you were to bring a Chinese mantis in the fall, they don't live terribly long. Their natural life cycle as they overwinter is an egg case, technically called an uetheca. In late spring, early summer, they hatch, they reach maturity in late summer. So that's when I get most of my reports. It'd be August to about October or so. They technically are not native here, but they are pretty much naturalized in North America. So also in terms of our ecosystem here in Wisconsin, I don't really get the impression that they are, you know, wreaking havoc on native species. So, you know, there's different terms thrown around, non-native, invasive, and so on. And if something is non-native, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a pest or a significant problem. I mean, think of ginkgo trees.
Sure.
Not native, but we have them planted and things like that. And so my thought is for praying mantids here, again, I don't see them wreaking havoc in the ecosystem. So I view them more as a curiosity. And I think there can be a big educational component. Folks just love to see these and watch them.
What makes a Chinese mantid a Chinese mantid? I mean, this looks a little, usually I see them as kind of a bright green or a lighter green, and this looks to be a little darker.
Yeah, I mean, with Chinese mantis, and the other species we get is the European mantis, which tends to be a bit smaller. So when someone finds a praying mantis in Wisconsin and it's about 4 inches, give or take a little bit more, that almost certainly will be the Chinese mantis. Their color can vary a bit, but usually brownish with some green on the body as well. Technically, the European mantis, if you were to look at the forearms, there's going to be a black and white spot basically where my bicep would be, and that helps separate our species. But we really only see those two species here in Wisconsin, so pretty easy to identify.
PJ, what about the news story from WPR's news on Monday? Danielle Kading from our Superior Bureau talking about the DNR and the state's debt cap on the lookout for an invasive species known as the hemlock woolly adelgid. I want to say aphid because when I tried to look it up online, the news stories all seem to, not here, but in the South, in Tennessee and stuff, say look out for the woolly aphid. What are we looking out for and how dangerous is it?
Yeah, so there is an invasive insect called the hemlock woolly adelgid, which is not native to Wisconsin or North America for that matter. It got into the country in the western U.S. about 1920s. Independent introduction got into Appalachia, part of Virginia, in about the 1950s, and it has really spread around almost the entire range of the Appalachian Mountains where you have hemlocks, and it has caused very significant damage there. Personally, I've driven through years ago some of the area near like Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and you'll just look out on hillsides and see dead hemlocks that have been killed by this insect.
Danielle's story says that it's killed millions of trees in the eastern U.S. and could threaten 80 million eastern hemlock trees here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so there it definitely is a threat to us. So the range of it, Appalachian Mountains, but a while back, it showed up in Michigan, and it's in some of the counties that border in western Lower Peninsula. So it borders Lake Michigan, which will serve as a barrier to us. But especially northern Wisconsin, we have quite a few hemlocks. So there's definitely some concern there. These insects, they're related to aphids. They're very small, and it's death by about 100,000 paper cuts. Each individual one, they suck out a little bit of sap, of fluids. Doesn't cause that much damage, but when you have gazillions of these on a tree, they're all sucking fluids.
What's it look like? How would you describe that picture?
Well, the thing that folks might notice on plants, these insects will create a structure called an ovisac, this little whitish kind of cottony thing. So imagine if you took the cotton swab at the end of a Q-tip.
So it is kind of woolly.
It is kind of woolly, yeah. Hence the name hemlock woolly adelgid. It's on hemlock trees. If you were to just pull off a little bit of that cottony material from a Q-tip and kind of stick it on like the needles or twig of a hemlock. That's what it would look like. But again, when I've seen this in Great Smoky Mountains area, you will just see hemlocks where the entire undersides of all the needles are coated with these. So again, each individual insect is only a few millimeters long, can't cause that much damage, but these things gang up on trees and it can cause potentially tree death over the span of maybe 4 to 5 years. If you had high populations, low populations, it might take a decade, 15 years or so on. It's also interesting because for a long time, looking at winter temperatures, winter mortality of these insects, we thought, you know, it's probably just cold enough for us here in Wisconsin. They'd have a hard time catching on. But some of these climate models are predicting that maybe by about 2050, that's only 25 years from now, things might have changed enough that could allow them to get a potential foothold. So it's something that Myself, colleagues at DNR, Department of Agriculture, we're keeping a close eye on because it's not in Wisconsin yet, but it's something that we don't want here.
PJ, weren't you back in the day on the lookout for the Emerald Ash Borer before it got? And what was that experience like, and how would it compare to the efforts now to keep this woolly adelgid out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some similarities there. So the way I got my foot in the door with entomology was as an undergraduate student. I was at UW Parkside at the time, and I got linked up with a researcher here in Madison, did some initial field surveys for emerald ash borer, which wasn't here yet, or we didn't know of it at the time in about, this was 2005 or so. The similarities are that both of those insects, EAB, emerald ash borer, and hemlock woolly adelgid, very difficult, challenging to detect at low population levels.
Yeah.
And by the time you might potentially see a population, it might have built up and spread. So that can be a challenge with these. We know that something like hemlock woolly adelgid could potentially be moved with nursery stock, so trees,
yeah,
plant material.
Sure.
There's concerns there. Luckily, there's a lot of inspections and regulations with nursery stock and the plant industry. So DATCAP, Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, is heavily involved with that realm. But if someone moves firewood, for example, mm-hmm, that could be another route of introduction. And firewood is so much harder to regulate because you could have someone that just throws some in their truck and drives.
So the woolly adelgid wouldn't necessarily just be on the hemlocks. It could be transported through other trees or other wood?
No, it's basically specific
to
hemlocks.
Okay.
Yeah. But again, it's something that we don't have in Wisconsin yet. We are keeping an eye out for it because if we were to detect it early, that gives us the best shot at knocking it out.
What are the ways that we are trying to detect it early? Low population, you're trying to find the first one so you can nip it in the bud. How do you find that first? What is the system like for detection?
Yeah, so it depends on the situation and context. I mean, with something like nursery stock,
yeah,
you got trees that are 2 feet tall or thereabouts. You know, things like visual inspections to look for anything out of the ordinary. That's a very common practice. In forested areas, you're looking for kind of a needle in the haystack.
Yeah.
It's such a huge number of trees, large areas. I have colleagues at the DNR and Department of Ag that, again, are doing some work with this. My colleague Mike Hillstrom with the DNR Forest Health Team, for example, I've collaborated with him with a 3D printer in my lab to help create some of these traps. And it's a disc that can be placed out into a forested area, and on the disc are little microscope slides. And the idea is if hemlock woolly adelgid happen to be present, you know, if things are blowing around in the wind, if any of their genetic material, DNA, happen to rain down and land on these, that could be checked just to help confirm the presence. And this technique has been used elsewhere, like up in Canada.
This is a disc of little slides, microscope slides,
yep,
that you're expecting DNA to rain down on, and then you take these slides back to the lab and actually look for the hemlock woolly adelgid DNA to see if it's present.
Yep.
Amazing.
So that general technique of, rather than trying to find the actual organism, the needle in the haystack, can you find evidence,
yes,
of its presence?
Yes.
That can be successful. And that's been used other realms of biology, looking for invasive carp in rivers and stuff like that. It's called eDNA. So again, that's what colleagues like Mike Hillstrom and the DNR and a lot of the efforts were trying to catch it early, get that early detection. That might give us the best chance of knocking something out, or at least give us the greatest number of management options versus if it shows up and it's absolutely everywhere.
PJ Leash is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, entomologist, thankful for bugs this Thanksgiving season. And if you've got questions of bugs, we are about running out of time. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Mark, we'll get to you next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Hey, tomorrow at this time, it'll be Thanksgiving, and a happy Thanksgiving to you. And we will be celebrating with Thanksgiving Turkey Confidential, a live call-in program giving you cooking advice on the fly from the team behind Splendid Table. That's tomorrow right here during this time from 11 to 1. So if you need help tomorrow, tune in. Or if you just want to listen to other folks who need help on the Thanksgiving dinner, give a listen tomorrow from 11 to 1 right here on WPR News. With the time we have left with our guest, entomologist PJ Leash, I want to get as many questions in as we can, and we'll start with Mark in Sussex. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. The great show as usual.
Thank you.
And those yellow jackets you're talking about are predators. You know, they're meat eaters. They get a lot of caterpillars, so they have a purpose besides being annoying.
Well, that's kind of your argument for being thankful for bugs this season, PJ, is that they all have a purpose beyond being annoying, right?
They do. And one thing I've really come to appreciate over time is context is so important. You know, it's easy for folks to ask, is this insect good or bad? And I think in my mind, you know, if I went down the sidewalk and saw a person and asked myself, are they good or bad? It's not clear cut like that. And of course, if you have a yellow jacket nest right outside your front door, and every time you open it, you're getting stung, you know, that's not a good situation. If that nest is in the back corner of your yard, no one ever goes there, they're 30 feet up in a tree, they're great predators. They will come into your garden or go to your landscape plants, and they will feed on caterpillars, sawfly larvae, and things like that. They are hunting that protein source because their developing larvae need protein to grow. So they can be really excellent predators.
Mark, I appreciate the context. Let's go to Patty in Windsor next. Patty, good morning.
Hi there. I had some woolly aphids on my apple trees. I just planted them this year. They were bare roots, so they're very young and vulnerable. And it looked like cotton all over them. What's the best way to get rid of that?
Yeah, so we had talked about hemlock woolly adelgid. There's also a very common type of insect called woolly aphids, and there's a bunch of different species on a whole range of different plants. They can be very common on some of our fruit trees, including apple trees, and it'll look just like this fuzzy material. Mm-hmm. To be honest, my family, we went out apple picking this fall, and lots of them out there too. In many situations, if it's a larger established tree, the trees tolerate it just fine, and there's a lot of natural enemies, predators and parasites, that sort of thing, that will feed on those and help keep them in check. On a small recent transplant, you know, that's a situation where you may want to intervene just to get that tree off to a good footing. To do something like that with a small plant, a very easy option you could do would be something I mentioned earlier, which would be along the lines of either insecticidal soap, which you can get at just about any hardware store, garden center, also horticultural oils. The caveat with those is they work by direct contact. You have to spray them onto the aphids for it to work. Once they dry, they're basically done working. There's no residual activity, but that can be a good way to deal with aphids. So if I ever have an aphid issue that I feel I need to treat, those are usually my first options, is try an insecticidal soap or horticulture oil. That can usually work pretty well. You need to watch because any survivors can kind of repopulate. But if you treat today, maybe check a week later. If there's some more, maybe hit them again with the soap. But that can be a really simple option to deal with them and low impact, environmentally speaking.
If the woolly adelgid were to make it to Wisconsin, would I be able to see the difference between a woolly adelgid and a woolly aphid?
Well, you would rely on some important clues.
Okay.
You know, things like host plant would be a key thing. If I see
anything
like that on a hemlock,
Yes. That's
a red flag. But if it's a different host plant, especially if you have a general idea of woolly aphids and all, they can be common in some of those, then it's generally not a concern. But
gotcha. If
you are not familiar with them, you know, some of these aphids, some of the adelgids, they're like a tenth of an inch long. So even under the microscope, you're going to have a hard time. And they're kind of blobby-like creatures, not a whole lot of features to look at on them. So it can make it tough. That's why in my role at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, I have to look at clues. Phenology, time of the year, the host plant is a huge clue, and integrate all these things to figure out what the particular insect is.
Insect detective.
Exactly.
Leash. Patty, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. We'll go to Jeff in La Crosse next. Jeff, good morning.
Hello. I'm calling about earlier in the show you had a part on the praying mantises.
Yeah.
And that reminded me of years ago when I was a more active gardener. From all the major garden supply catalogs, they offered these praying mantis pod-like things that you could hang in and around the garden to help control pests. But they wouldn't winter over, and so you didn't have to worry about them becoming a problem as an invasive species. But now with global warming, I'm wondering how dangerous that is.
Yeah, again, I still feel the, you know, the risk from these things is quite low, and I view them more of as a curiosity in my mind. Where we see them in Wisconsin, it's basically the lower tiers of counties, south central Wisconsin. I've had them up through Dane County into Sauk County on occasion, over to southeastern Wisconsin, maybe up towards like Sheboygan, where Lake Michigan kind of moderates things. I've never had a report of them from like up in the North Woods, for example. But again, they don't seem to be out there wreaking havoc in the ecosystem. Can they be predators? Yes. But usually what happens is, and Jeff, you're absolutely right. Sometimes gardening catalogs, you can buy what's called an uatheca. That's an egg case. It's this little styrofoam kind of consistency egg case. Those can hatch out. I have found these myself and overwintered them, got the young to hatch out in the spring, and you might get 100, 150 of them. What is going to happen, though, is you might get a few adults out of that batch. There's extremely high mortality. There's going to be cannibalism. They're just going to eat each other when they're little. A lot of them are going to die due to environmental conditions or maybe during a molt, a limb gets stuck or antenna gets stuck, something like that. And so out of 100, 150 eggs, you know, you might end up with a couple of adults out of that batch. You know, if you are rearing them and raising them in cages, you can increase the success rate. But I don't think of them as really being a great biocontrol in your garden because a lot of them are going to die. You can't contain them when they become adults. They can just fly off or they can walk away, that sort of thing. If I wanted to purchase a beneficial predator or parasitic insect, there's some other things I would choose. Things like lacewing larvae, for example, that aren't really going to be able to fly away because they don't have wings. So I know they're sometimes sold, but probably not really going to solve a whole lot of problems in your yard or garden for you.
Great question, Jeff. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Robin in Portage next. Robin, good morning. You're on the air with PJ Leash.
Good morning. I am going back to the Asian beetle.
Mm-hmm.
I have this question. I haven't seen a real ladybug for years.
Well, that
and
is...
Are they being killed off?
Oh, what? First of all, how would I know the difference between a real ladybug, as Robin, you know, refers to him as I know him, and the multicolored Asian lady beetle?
Yeah, so we actually have a whole bunch of different species of lady beetles. They belong to a family, Coccinellidae, which we just commonly call the lady beetles. I will say there are some species that most folks probably wouldn't recognize if they saw them because they're very, very small, like a couple of millimeters long.
Oh,
and they tend to specialize on feeding on things like spider mites and stuff like that. So very, very small, easy to overlook. There are, of course, are other lady bugs or lady beetles. And one thing that we've seen with this non-native multicolored Asian lady beetle is there has been some displacement of native lady beetles.
Okay.
And we do also have other non-native species of lady beetles that are out there that are basically naturalized at this point. But these multicolored Asian lady beetles, they tend to be physically a bit larger than some of our other lady beetles. And so if you are, you know, on a leaf and you're vying for food, aphids to feed on and stuff like that, and you're bigger and you can kind of elbow others out of the way, that's going to help you out. So some of that definitely has happened. We've seen some drops in populations of other lady beetles. They're generally still out there, but you really have to go looking for them in some cases. Whereas when you ask folks, what's the species they see in their yard?
Yeah.
A lot of cases, it's that multicolored Asian lady beetle. To actually tell that species apart, one thing to look for is just behind the head, they've got a region called the pronotum. It's this broad kind of neck-like region, and it's whitish, and there's going to be a black either M or W shape, depending on if you're a Badger fan or a Gopher fan.
Or if you're a Michigan
M or W.
Fan.
Yeah. Yep, something like that. But there's this zigzag M or W pattern that helps identify that species.
And that would be the multicolored Asian lady beetle with
yes.
the M or W, depending on who you're cheering for.
Yep.
Great question, Robin. Thank you so much for calling. I think we got time for maybe one more here. Tom in River Falls, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. My concern is I was recently skinning a deer, and between the hide and the meat, there were wood ticks.
Huh.
How common is this? Because I have never seen that or heard of that before.
Just to be clear here, you're skinning a deer from, you know, you killed for deer season, and as you take down the skin, you've got ticks that are between the meat and the skin?
That is correct.
How many?
Oh, I probably would say altogether maybe 10.
Okay.
I would find like a couple here and a couple there. You know, I first noticed them, and most of them were around the neck and shoulder area.
Interesting. PJ, what do you think?
Well, I mean, when ticks feed, they basically insert their mouth parts into the skin. They're not capable of burrowing in. In a situation like this, I'd really love to see some pictures of what was going on. What I wonder is if there had been some ticks on the deer and you're in the process of skinning it, those may have moved on. That's what I wonder about having happened.
Because the idea of a tick actually burrowing in and getting its whole body through that's not what ticks generally would do.
Right. They can't do that. They're not capable of burrowing in like that.
But that's the way Tom made it sound. So it's like most likely scenario is that once the deer was killed and that the ticks knew that their gig was up, that they started moving around, shuffling and trying to find meat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I have a colleague, Dr. Susan Paskowitz, our medical entomologist, and her team has actually done some really cool tick research where years ago they would have folks from the lab at deer stations. So when folks are bringing in deer to register them, they were taking tick samples and assessing for things like that. So there's actually some cool research that's been done with deer hunting and ticks in mind.
Tom, thanks for the call. A quick one here, PJ, if we've got time for. Bill in Oregon emailed us. He's surprised to see moths and butterflies in early spring. Bill believes that most species overwinter in Wisconsin is either eggs or larvae. For the species that overwinter as adults, what traits or strategies allow them to survive Wisconsin's winter?
Yeah, so really, they have quite a few kind of tricks up their sleeve. A lot of insects that can survive the winter as adults, or really larvae or pupae for that matter, they have some physiological tricks. They can basically make kind of some antifreeze chemicals in their body that can help them. But especially for moths and butterflies, and there definitely are some that overwinter as adults, they are typically looking for sheltered locations.
Okay.
That's under loose bark of a dead tree, or a lot will get down amongst the leaf litter.
Sure.
On the ground. And think about it, if that leaf litter is then covered by snow, that really buffers them temperature-wise. So as soon as things start melting in spring, or if there's a warm-up in the winter, you could have some moths or butterflies, like the morning cloak butterfly is one I see very early in the year. You can bump into things flying around times of the year that you generally wouldn't necessarily expect them.
And that would be because of the overwintering as adults? And,
yes.
But I would imagine, like other insects, it's probably, you know, the odds are likely against you.
Well, again, they have these strategies to help them get into these very sheltered locations. If you are amongst leaf litter, covered by 4 or 6 inches of snow, even if it's minus 20 above, that space, the junction between the ground and the snow, it's called the subnivium. That's a very special, unique environment where that temperature is very much buffered and moderated, and that can really help them survive.
PJ Leash, today we are thankful for you. Thanks so much for joining us today, as always.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, appreciate seeing the world through your eyes, the big picture and the smallest pictures that we can find. Entomologist PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you are interested, you can always send a picture his way. You can Google the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. You'll find the way to get PJ Leash your pictures. And when he's got the time, he'll get you the answers. When we continue on the Larry Mueller Show today, Wisconsin author James Campbell has a brand new book out, and you're going to want to hear about it. Cat lovers unite and take over. This is the heart of the jaguar and one of the biggest stories of conservation we've seen in this hemisphere. And that's after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to the Larry Mueller Show.